these concerts are kind of a respite from all of the difficult stuff that's going on in the world and the news, and that we're offering a kind of salve for the soul. But I think more important than music as a distraction is music as deep engagement. And that's what happens. And the audience feels it, the musicians feel it, and it's just extraordinary.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Karen Kevra was passionate about playing the flute as a child, but in college, she became disillusioned and walked away from classical music. Her long and winding journey brought her back to music and in the process transformed the music scene in Vermont. Kevra is founder and artistic director of Capital City Concerts, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. It has become one of Vermont's premier and most beloved chamber music series, holding concerts in Montpelier and Burlington. Kevra is a Grammy-nominated flutist who performs at each of the Capital City concerts. She has shared the stage with members of the Emerson String Quartet, the Paris Piano Trio, the Borromeo String Quartet, the Boston Chamber Music Society, and Trey Anastasio of Phish. Kevra, who is on the music faculty of Middlebury College, has performed throughout the U.S., Canada, and Europe, including performances at Carnegie Hall and the French Embassy in Washington, D.C. When the COVID pandemic closed down performance venues, Kevra turned to telling stories. She launched a podcast, Muse Mentors, a series of beautifully crafted interviews with artists, activists, and thinkers in which she explores the transformative role that mentors have played in their lives. Kevra credits her own mentor with changing the course of her life. As an adult, Karen Kevra sought out a teacher, Louis Moyes, a renowned flutist, composer, and co-founder of the Marlborough Music Festival. Their musical relationship blossomed into a lifelong friendship until Moyes' death in 2007 at the age of 94. Here is an excerpt of flutist Karen Kevra and pianist Jeffrey Chappelle performing the Sonata Undine for flute and piano by Carl Reinecke. Karen Kevra, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me back again.
Your musical journey seems like a uniquely circuitous Vermont story. So I wonder if you could take us on the twists and turns of your musical journey that has led you to now celebrating the 25th anniversary of one of the premier chamber music series in Vermont. But you were working at a co-op. a food co-op at the time that you kind of rediscovered your musical passion. So tell us a little of that story.
It's true. I was working at the Plainfield Food Co-op, then the Winooski Valley Co-op. I had an infant son, Owen, and I realized that it was time to come back to the flute. In fact, within a couple of days of Owen being born, I started to really practice again. And I did that for several months and got more serious about it. I connected with a pretty well-known freelance flutist in New York City, Eleanor Lawrence, who was actually a student of Marcel Moyse, part of the important Moyse family, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. And I started to do the 3 hours of practice a day that I had done when I was a student and really committed to it. And it was actually Eleanor Lawrence who suggested to me that I look up Louis Moyse. She told me he was living in the Adirondacks in New York and that I had better get on that quickly because he was old. He was in his 80s and she thought I would find him very inspiring.
So let me understand, were you a very serious flute student in high school and also in college? How long was your kind of hiatus from music?
I was a very serious flute student from the day that I got my first flute in the fourth grade and opened it up and put it together. And it took 2 weeks for my band teacher to figure out it was broken. But I so badly wanted to play it, got it repaired, and got through that beginning band book in about 2 weeks and really loved it. You know, I just knew, I knew then that it was the most important thing in the world to me. So I was very serious through high school, worked very, very hard, took
and
college
where
auditions.
Was high school?
High school was in Somerset, New Jersey, in central New Jersey near Rutgers University. I came from a not at all musical family and didn't take the best or most direct path in my studies. My first private teacher was a clarinet player, and my second one was a trumpet player. Yeah, it took a little while for me to get on the right path, really, until I was about a senior in high school. So I applied to a lot of different schools and did several auditions and applied to a musical competition. I don't even remember the group anymore. It was a Central New Jersey group, and I won it. And the prize was free tuition to the North Carolina School of the Arts. So that's where I went. There was no discussion about going anywhere else because my parents were finishing putting up my older sister through college, and my twin sister was about to go off to Oberlin. So off I went to the North Carolina School of the Arts and hated it. I was so.
And this was, you were attending as a college student.
Yes. Yes. I did the work. I practiced a lot, but I was absolutely miserable there. I'm
Why?
Not sure. Yeah. Why?
I mean, it seems like a dream for somebody whose passion was ignited at age 9.
It seems that way. I don't know. I think some of it was homesickness. I think there was an existential thing going on in the sense that I very much missed my twin sister and that, you know, we were kind of a unit for all of those years of our lives. I felt a little lost without her. And then I had an accident and I fell down and I broke my arm and I ended up leaving school and stopped playing for, I don't know, a period of a few months, and then got hooked on playing for contra dances and for playing Celtic music, which I loved. And it was incredible for my low register, really kept my fingers moving. I loved the quality of dance that is a part of that kind of music. I mean, it's inherent in it. And to this day, I really believe that if you can't feel the beat in your body, you really can't make music. And that was something that Just, I felt in my tissues, I think, from that point forward.
So it's interesting that your path forward in music began with kind of throwing off the more formal constraints of classical music, where you play on the beat and you practice with the metronome, for the kind of freewheeling spirit of contradance.
I think it was really, in a lot of ways, a lifestyle kind of thing. I soon after I left college went and worked on a couple of different organic farms in Massachusetts. That's become sort of a fashionable thing to do now. It wasn't then. And contra dancing is still very much alive and well in the Pioneer Valley in Massachusetts. And that's where I was. And so I got into contra dancing while I was there. And it just became kind of a part of me and a comfortable part of expression. I actually loved that the formality seemed to be gone, that you could just show up and play. And yes, it was to make music for dancers, but it was very comfortable and freeing and fun.
All right. Well, I want to circle back now and get you to introduce Louis Moise, who's such an important figure in your life, but also in the musical life of Vermont. So, who was he?
Louis Moise's name seemed to be on nearly every volume of flute music I had as a kid and into high school and into college. He was a composer and an editor, and he wrote exercise books and he wrote large scale pieces of music for the flute and the flute in other configurations with other instruments. So I'd always seen his name and recognized it. As I mentioned before, Eleanor Lawrence brought it up, but a couple of years went by and I started to perform in the Montpelier area. And after one of the performances I did, Jim Lowe, the longtime arts editor for the Times Argus, invited several of us over for a reception after a concert. And while we were there, he started to talk about the Moises, as he would often do. And I said, "Oh, do you have any recordings of Marcel Moise, Louis Moise's father?" And he said, "I do." And he played me some Mozart. But then he said, "What you really want to hear is Louis." And he put on a recording of a piece from an aria by Bach. It's a beautiful, boy, you could call it a lullaby. And it is, but it is one of the most sublime and profound pieces of music I've ever heard. I think it is the most beautiful piece of music Bach ever wrote. And Louis Moise was the flutist on this recording, and he was performing with Bonita Valente, who was the soprano and a host of strings. And it blew my mind. I'd never heard flute playing like that before, and I'd never heard music making like that before. And so that was it. I finally decided to screw up my courage and pick up the phone and make a phone call to go and play for Louis Moise in hopes of being able to study with him.
We're going to go to a cut of that recording of Louis Moise soprano Bonita Valente playing. Karen, introduce it for us.
This is J.S. Bach's aria Süßer Trost from Cantata number 151.
Thank you. Karen, bring us back in and just tell us what we just heard an excerpt of here.
So that was an excerpt from Bach's Süßertrost aria from his cantata 151 with Louis Moyes performing on flute. Benita Valente is the soprano, and the orchestra was conducted by Blanche Moyes from 1974 at the New England Bach Festival.
When you listen to that, what do you hear?
I think that it brings up first emotions for me, my deep gratitude to Louis for forgiving me what I really was seeking for so many years, which was to be able to understand music. I hear that in there, and I become nostalgic thinking about all the years that I worked with him and how important he was to me and how much I loved him and still do. And also the quality of this music that, well, you know, we just had Mother's Day. This is a celebration of the gift of a baby, of a child. And what could go more to the heart than that for us as humans?
Tell us the story of you summoning up your courage to visit and play for this musical master who was living over in New York when you went to seek him out.
Yeah, Louis and his wife Janet were living in Westport, New York, and I made a phone call and I spoke with Janet because Louis did not like or trust the telephone, and we set up a date. It was about the third week in September, and I still remember the quality of that light. At the time, I was living in Montpelier, and I had to drive over the App Gap and find my way across the lake to Westport, New York, and driving down their incredible driveway with huge twisted locust trees and Janet's beautiful gardens. And I was very excited to be there, and I admit a little bit nervous. And I spoke with Janet for a while, and she took me into the house and wanted to introduce me to Louis. He was just then finishing up practicing his morning Beethoven piano sonatas, because the thing you have to remember is that not only was he a world-class flutist and composer, but also a world-class pianist. He played the piano every day, every morning. Anyway, when he finished playing his Beethoven, he looked up from the piano and we locked eyes and we both smiled. And I knew in that moment that my life was going to change. And boy, did it.
So you played for him. You played for a while for him. He kept asking you to continue to add and play another piece. And what did he say? And you say when you were done performing for him?
Yeah, when I finished, I should mention that he had his eyes closed the whole time and I knew he was listening intently. But when I finished, he opened his eyes and he said to me, "Why did you come here?" And I said, "Because I want to understand music." And sometimes people are horrified when I tell that story, that's such a direct question that it, you know, might send me running for the exits. But I thought it was a perfectly fair and reasonable question, and my answer could not have been more organic. I also think it was the right answer, but it was the true answer.
And then what happened from there?
Well, from there, I began making my little pilgrimage over there once a week and having a long lesson with him, about 2 hours every week. And sometimes if I was able, I would stick around and have lunch with them. Janet was an amazing cook. She would make incredibly delicious French food. She was not French, but Louis was, and we always had wine with our meal, and then I'd have to pack up and get in the car and drive home and teach for 4 hours in the afternoon. But it was incredibly inspiring, and every morning I bounded out of bed. I couldn't wait to practice, and couldn't wait to go back for my next lesson. One of the things I noticed the day that I first drove there was that there was a for sale sign outside of the house. And I thought, oh dear, how is this going to go? It would be terrible if they sold their house and moved. And, you know, that would be the end of the lessons. But I actually brought it up to them and they said, oh, that's the house has been on the market for 8 years. It won't sell. Well, wouldn't you know, within a few months, it sold and they needed to make some new plans. They were planning to actually move back to France, but they needed a place to live for the summer. And I kind of offhandedly said, why don't you move to Montpelier? Which got a little bit of a lukewarm response until I showed up the next week. And then Janet said to me, Louis and I were talking and we were thinking maybe you could help us find a place in Montpelier.
Were you and his, was he teaching anyone else at that point or just you?
I don't think he was teaching anyone else at that point. I think in a lot of ways he was beginning to kind of shut down. He was recovering from a cancer operation, you know, within a few months of before I met him. So he was a bit frail. But the teaching, I think the teaching brought him back to life in a lot of ways. And then he moved to Montpelier and I introduced him to other students. And then more students started to travel from really all over the world to come and study with him. I set up some master classes for him to do. And, you know, it really changed my life, but it changed his life too.
And out of this comes your, well, how did Capital City Concerts, this now celebrating its 25th anniversary, but how did it come about?
I think I was complaining to Louis one day that there just weren't enough opportunities for performers in Vermont. We're talking, you know, like around 1995, 96. And he said, well, why don't you do what we did when I was in Brattleboro, invite your friends to come and play. And so that's what I did. I had a circle of wonderful, accomplished friends that I started to invite to play. And then that circle began to grow and grow and grow, you know, the different kind of branches of the tree. And it continues to grow to this day.
And you were inviting up really throughout this series, remarkable, you know, world-renowned performers. You had the Emerson String Quartet, the Paris Piano Trio, the Borromeo String Quartet, and a local musician named Trey Anastasio were among the people who you were collaborating with. Now, Trey Anastasio, of course, is from Vermont, but the others are, you know, touring the world. Why? What made you think you could bring them to Montpelier, Vermont?
Because I was young and naive, and I figured I'll just ask them and we'll see what they say. Musicians want to perform. And so they were happy to come. And my current problem is that everyone's always clamoring to come back. And, you know, we can only do so many concerts a year, but musicians want to play, but they really want to play here. The audience at Capital City Concerts, I'm told, and I believe it, by musicians who come from all over the world, is incredibly special. And there's a connection that happens that is unbelievably rewarding. You know, I think that one of the things we've even done over the past several years in terms a little bit of marketing is to let people know that these concerts are kind of a respite from all of the difficult stuff that's going on in the world and the news, and that we're offering a kind of salve for the soul. But I think more important than music as a distraction is music as deep engagement. And that's what happens. And the audience feels it, the musicians feel it, and it's just extraordinary.
Well, I had the experience of going, attending one of the concerts. I've been on and off a fan over the many years, and was there in March, which was kind of a wonderful celebration that included over two dozen of your students on the flute coming to perform. What was that like for you? That must have been quite a moment to see them packed in on the stage of the Unitarian Church in Montpelier, and you conducting them.
Oh, it was a it had an incredible sense of homecoming because it wasn't just current students. In fact, it was largely not my current students. It was students that I've taught over these many years, over 30 years in Vermont. What I basically did was I went through and sent emails to every former student I could think of and invited them to come and play the Dona Nobis Pacem round, which of course we all know and love and lies so beautifully on the flute. And I couldn't believe the response I got. So I had students, current students who are 11, 12 years old, all the way up through adult students who are in their 80s, and also, students who I taught all through high school who now have kids of their own who are studying music. It was really incredible and incredibly, I don't know. It was a real moment of affection and nostalgia for me.
So you have worn many hats. You're a performer, a teacher, and also now a mentor, and that was very much in evidence at that concert. What's the difference between those three? And feel free to add any other hats that you feel you wear.
Well, I think it's possible to have a teacher who is a teacher, but not really a mentor. I guess it brings up the question of what is a mentor? And this was something I was exploring when I was doing my Muse Mentors podcast project during the pandemic. The whole idea of what makes a mentor. And I think that really it's someone who shows you how to live life. It's someone who engages with you. It's someone who, if they look at you in a particular way, you understand what it is they're trying to get across. It's a deep personal connection. It's incredibly inspiring. And I would say it's incredibly important, particularly in the age we're living in. You think about how not just young people, but we're all so addicted to our devices and our gadgets, plugged in all of the time. Having this time with a student where you see them one-on-one for a week and none of those distractions are there, and it is just the two of you, and you do this every week, week after week, month after month, year after year, and you kind of grow up with these kids. It is kind of the honor of a lifetime for me to have known so many students for such a long time and to continue to be in touch with them. In some ways, I think it's probably the most rewarding thing I've done.
You mentioned that music can be a respite. And I think about the current moment we're in, a time of political turmoil, but more importantly, in the conversations that I have with friends, a real emotional turmoil for a lot of people. What is the role of music in times like these? And I guess I'm also thinking about other times in history, especially times of political repression, where music played a role in some form.
I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about, a level of deep engagement. We think about culture. Typically, I think we think of it as a noun, but I think in some ways it's more of a verb. It's something that we do together. There are so many examples of music that's been born out of of difficult times. I think probably the best music comes out of the hard times rather than the happy times. Politically, you could almost consider it to be a genre. I think of all of the pieces, maybe the most profound one that I'm sure you know well is Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, which is,
I had a feeling you were going to mention
yeah,
that.
just one of the most incredible pieces of music. Those who are listening should look it up. And in fact, we have a,
Well, we should say something about, just tell a little of the story about that.
I will. And Capital City Concerts has a kind of a special connection to it. You mentioned the Paris Piano Trio earlier. Régis Pasquier, who is the incredible violinist from that Paris-based group, his uncle, Étienne Pasquier, was the cellist of the premiere of the Quartet for the End of Time. The Quartet for the End of Time was written by Messiaen when he was in a prisoner of war camp in Germany under horrible conditions, freezing cold conditions. He was lucky in that the guards there kind of took a shine to him and liked music, and so they allowed him to actually compose. So he wrote this piece of music, and it was performed in the dead of winter in 1941, and for an audience of prisoners and also soldiers, a lot of people who had never heard chamber music before. And he recounted later that he had never been listened to with so much attention and understanding. And, it's an interesting piece too, in that he had to compose for the musicians and the instruments he had on hand. So there was a violin, a cello, a clarinet, and a piano, and none of them were in good shape. The piano had keys that, stuck down. You'd have to kind of flick them back up with your finger to get them to respond again. But even so, this happened then, and it is just a piece of music that has stood the test of time and is unbelievably powerful and moving.
Since music speaks louder than words, here is the fourth movement of Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, performed by clarinetist Paul Meyer, violinist Gil Shaham, and others. That was the fourth movement of Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, performed by violinist Gil Shaham, clarinetist Paul Meyer, Jian Wang on cello, and Myung Won Chung on piano. I also want to go out on a closing thought of yours, although not a closing thought. 25 years is a remarkable accomplishment, but it's not the end. I don't know if it's the middle of your story, but it's in the middle of your story somewhere. What are you proudest of that you've accomplished with on reaching this milestone?
I think I'm proudest of what Capital City Concerts has come to mean to the community, that the audience has come to rely upon the concerts through our collective lives. And it's not been an easy 25 years politically, in terms of floods. There have been so many challenges, the COVID pandemic, the fact that we've continued to do this and that people still come, that they still want to gather, that they still want to have that powerful experience of listening in a group, is really the best thing of all.
Well, Karen Kever, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation, and happy 25th anniversary of your remarkable concert series, Capital City Concerts.
Thanks.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.